Anger from the studios of KXCI in downtown Tucson on a lovely Sunday afternoon. I'm here with a panel of stellar women who are going to help us all celebrate International Women's Day. And we're going to start that celebration, before I even introduce them, by reminding everyone about our many, many sisters who are on the move around the globe today, women who have been forced to leave their homes to seek safety, to seek housing and food and education for their children. We honor them and the enormous struggles they are going through. We are seeing unprecedented numbers today. Nearly 60 million people around the globe are forcibly displaced from their homes. That's as many as the 24th largest country in the world. Many of these refugees, as we all know, are from Syria, but also from Iraq, from Afghanistan, Sudan, El Salvador, Guatemala, Mexico. And even in October, UNHCR issued a warning to raise awareness about women in Central America who are fleeing their countries in ever-increasing numbers to escape a surge in deadly, unchecked gang violence. So we see along our own border women who are on their feet trying to find a better life for themselves. And so we honor them today as we sit comfortably in our studio at KXCI. And I'm going to introduce our panelists to you. We have a good range of women here. We'll be talking about migration and other things. So first, let me introduce to you an expert on migration across the U.S.-Mexico border, Ana Ochoa O'Leary. Dr. O'Leary is an anthropologist and is the head of the Mexican-American Studies Department at the U of A. She began her career as a number of us did, as an activist. She was in the massive copper strike at Morenci in the 80s. As a result of that work, she was elected a delegate to the Decade of Women's Conference in Nairobi, Kenya, a really very important part of women's history globally in the mid-80s. She went on to become an anthropologist and has more recently been researching women and transnational migration on the U.S. border. She has published many articles in both English and Spanish on migration and gender, and is the editor of a two-volume reference work, Undocumented Immigrants in the United States Today, an Encyclopedia of Their Experiences. Welcome, Ana.
Thank you very much.
And we'll get back to Ana real soon, but next I'm going to introduce Linda Lumsden, who teaches journalism history, ethics, and gender. I also teaches on race and journalism at the University of Arizona. Her most recent book is Black, White, and Red All Over, A Cultural History of the Radical Press in Its Heyday, which is not today. It was from the 1900s to 1917. She's written extensively about women in journalism and the suffrage movement and is now working on a history of the social movement media. So, Linda, welcome.
Thanks. It's a pleasure.
We'll hear from her in just a second to give us a little background on International Women's Day. But first, I want to introduce you to Atifa Rawan, who is from Afghanistan. She is an emeritus librarian at the U of A with expertise in Afghan culture and languages. She began her education in Kabul, but quickly moved on to Hawaii, New York University, and the University of South Carolina. She's received a number of state and national awards and grants for her work in Afghanistan, has been involved in a number of campus-wide projects and activities related to Afghanistan, and is a frequent traveler there as a trainer and a consultant. In fact, we have traveled there a time or two together, and she has been an endless source of information for me on a project on Afghanistan. But her primary focus has been on rebuilding the libraries in Afghanistan and in training Afghans in library science, a truly noble effort. And welcome, Atifa.
Thank you.
Next is Adele Barker. Her area of expertise is Russia. In fact, it's post-Stalinist literature in particular. But her interests over the past 10 years have kind of expanded to include South Asia. She is the author of Not Quite Paradise, An American Sojourn in Sri Lanka, that chronicles the years she spent teaching in Sri Lanka during the Civil War with the Tamil Tigers and the government, and also the tsunami that we all remember hit Sri Lanka as heavily as much of the South Pacific. Most recently, Adele was teaching for a year at the Fatima Jinnah Women's University in Rawalpindi, Pakistan, and she's currently working on a book about young women of Pakistan. So we welcome her.
Thank you. A pleasure.
And our youngest colleague is Laura Tarantini from Bologna, a town in northern Italy that's famous for its political and social movements. And it seems to have had an impact on her because her early political activism in her teens was inspired by the anti-Berlusconi movement.
Yep.
And I often think of Berlusconi as we watch Donald Trump rise to the presidency. I'd like to talk to you about that sometime.
Yes.
I keep wondering if there are parallels there. And how many years was Berlusconi at the head?
Well, on and off for 20 years.
Oh,
but he's still there since 1993, 1994. So
we don't need to hear that. Thank you. but by the time Laura was 16, she was quite fascinated by riot girl bands and began playing drums and was a drummer for more than a decade, including with an all-female tribute band to Led Zeppelin. And if you can see Laura, she's a very tiny person. And I'm sure more than once people said to her, gee, you play drums like a man.
Sort of.
But she left her potential rock and roll stardom to pursue her academic interest in the Middle East. She's now at the University of Arizona finishing her master's degree in Middle Eastern and North African studies and will start a PhD in the fall. Her master's thesis is on Inspire, which is an English language magazine published by Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula. She's trying to get beyond the usual jihadi themes to expose lesser known topics like social justice and jihadi environmentalism. I'm very glad they feel nurturing towards the planet. welcome, Laura.
Thank you. Thanks.
let's start out first with Linda, the historian, who, Linda, can you explain to us a little bit about what International Women's Day is? Where did this come from?
Sure. Yeah. International Women's Day goes back beyond women's liberation movement of the 1960s. 1970s, like you might think. It goes back beyond when women got the vote in the U.S. anyway in 1920. And it goes all the way back to the first decade of the 20th century. And it was basically the idea of what we call the social feminists. And they were women who were very interested in equity for labor and also votes for women, and also sort of took their feminist theory from Marx and sort of expanded his critique of capitalism to say that women's oppression was because they were oppressed by the capitalism. Okay, the society depended on their free labor, and actually women were dependent financially on marriage, et cetera, and were really couldn't make it on their own without that. This was a really exciting time to be in New York when all these new women were deciding that, you know, they could get jobs and they could go out and party and also work hard and get the vote. They could do anything they wanted to. And this actually went down to the factory workers, garment workers, who were making shirtwaists, which was the modern new dress that all these young feminists were wearing. But the people who made them were pretty oppressed, and they gathered in one of the earliest women's unions to strike against the shirtwaist makers down in Lower East Side. And they took them on, and it's called the Uprising of the 20,000. And it really is kind of a milestone because it proved that these women took to the streets, which, think about it, that's a radical idea. They showed that women weren't too emotional or too timid to organize and to take on the powers that be. And they picketed throughout the rough winter of 1909, 1910. They were arrested, they were beat up, and at the end of it, most of them got contracts that gave them higher wages, fewer hours, and some more safeguards. They didn't get their union, but anyways, it was a really big deal in starting the getting the International Ladies Garment Workers Union on the road. In the midst of this, one of the biggest supporters was the Call newspaper. New York Call was a socialist newspaper. And a lot of their supporters, too, in this strike were upper-class women. It was really a cross-class collaboration, not without its tensions. But people were so pleased in this small sort of leftist circle of New York City to see women win some rights in the workplace, that the call, I think, pretty much manufactured a Women's Day, which was February 27th, 1910, and woman with an A, they used a singular then, and to celebrate their great victory and, quote, their heroic resistance. The idea that women could be actors, have agency, be heroes, was a big deal. There was another feminist on the other side of the Atlantic named Clara Zetkin, who was very active with the German socialists, and she was challenging, as the Americans were, the dominance of men in the socialist organization. And so before the International Socialist Congress that year in Denmark, she called a special women's congress. About 100 socialist women from all over the world showed up, and she suggested, I think that we should have an International Women's Day that's along the lines of the Americans' Women's Day, and to sort of, you know, celebrate women's struggles, etc. They thought that was a great idea, and so the first International Women's Day was celebrated March 11th, 1911, in four countries in Europe. By 1914, it was celebrated in a few more countries. In Russia, the organizers of it were all arrested before the day came, so there was no International Women's Day. In 1917, nonetheless, about 9,000 women showed up in St. Petersburg on March 8th to protest for peace and for rising bread prices. People were starving. That led to the February Revolution, which led to the abdication of the Tsar. And, of course, the provisional government was set up, and then the November Revolution occurs at the end of the year, and the Bolsheviks win, and one of the first things they do is declare March 8th a national holiday for women around the world. Just to wrap this up, you may wonder why this has never caught on in the West, and many people have never heard of this, although most of the countries, they celebrate it. Mm-hmm. It's because of those communist roots. And as the Cold War progressed, you know, sort of died out during the two world wars, 50s and 60s, it was, you know, you couldn't do anything without being called a communist. And so the day never caught on. It sort of got a second breath during the second wave of women's liberation, when women's history was being restored. People discovered, hey, we had an International Women's Day, you know, 60 years ago. Let's do it again. And some women's liberals groups did mark the day. If you look at the Black Panther newspaper, they always had a big write-up about the day. It started to gain more legitimacy when the UN in 1977 declared a Women's Day, International Women's Day for Women's Rights and Peace. And that sort of took the, you know, the leftist sting out of it. Today, it's celebrated in a bunch of countries, most of them former Soviet bloc, some in Asia, some in Africa. The only country in which this official holiday in all of the Americas is Cuba. there are some celebrations, and we can mention later, scattered throughout our country and around the world. And basically, it has different ways of being celebrated now. Some, it's become sort of a social thing. In Cameroon, it's just a parade. A lot of places, it still has a sort of a call to action that's still retained. And in fact, in New York City, City Hall at 11 a.m. on Tuesday, the, let's see, what is the name of it? The Rape Whistle Choir will be performing and calling for an end to rape to mark International Women's Day.
Great. I had no idea. I really had no idea whatsoever. But I think that we might pick up with Adele from there, maybe to talk about Communist Soviet Union and about the status of women there, since they, I think, are generally considered well ahead of the capitalist countries in champion women's rights.
Yeah, absolutely. This is a tradition that has deep, deep roots over there in Russia. In the Soviet Union, and even today, it was, it still is, it's celebrated, and it's celebrated with flowers being given to women all over the country. Now, if you think about it, it's actually still the dead of winter over there, so nothing's really growing. So they sometimes set up separate hothouses in Siberia to grow crocus and roses, and the men go out and they buy all of these things for women, and they get boxes of chocolates, etc., etc. And that's on International Women's Day. Now, that's the surface. Let's let's dig a little bit. Let's go underneath and see what's really growing over there. Lenin thought that if he and the Bolsheviks would liberate women in the workplace, that they would get liberated domestically as well, that they would get liberated on the home front. Whoops, this actually didn't happen. So in the first heady years of the revolution, 1917 to 1921, nobody really paid a whole lot of attention to this because everybody was involved in building a new society. And there were communal kitchens set up, communal nurseries. But as the years went on, it became progressively more clear that women were shouldering not only the burden or of being liberated, and indeed, they were doing things in the workplace way before, decades before women were over here. Valentina Tereshkova, the cosmonaut, women were doctors, they were engineers, they were out there doing man's work. And domestically, they were still doing the work at home, which in the Soviet Union throughout the greater part of the 20th century was about 10 times more difficult than it is over here. So they called it the dvoyaya nosha, the double burden. Some women over there would argue that it was actually a triple burden. So there was, but the ideology won the day. And on the surface, in all of the papers, and on film, and on the TV stations, this was celebrating Women's Day. When Gorbachev came to power in 1985, he also, it was very interesting because he was trying to introduce reforms and yet keep the socialist system. And one of the things that he said in his memoirs is that women ought to return to their womanly, wifely duties, which, of course, caused an incredible stir. And as I think a lot of the listeners today know, there's been, in the past few years, there's been the unfortunate occurrence of what happened to the rock group Pussy Riot, and a young women's group who performed in the Cathedral of Christ the Savior in Moscow and were arrested and imprisoned. And this actually reflects a kind of a backward movement that you see under Putin, where you're having a much closer relationship with the Orthodox Church, between the government and the Orthodox Church. And so there's really a lot of Russian women are saying, well, you know, three steps forward, five back. So that, you know, they're still struggling. And so for International Women's Day, now people will celebrate and they'll eat the chocolates and they'll smell the flowers, and they'll also, many of them are going out and they're actually demonstrating against inequality and unequal wages.
Great. Well, these are a lot of the same issues women are dealing with everywhere, right? Doesn't this sound familiar?
Absolutely.
We keep talking about, can women have it all? Can you clean the house and can you work at the same time and raise the children? So these are ongoing struggles, I think, everywhere. And does anyone have anything to add to that? I wanted to also talk about, to move on a little bit more about violence directly against women, because this is something also that unfortunately women share around the world. And Adele, since you have just spent quite a bit of time in Pakistan, we all took note, I think, of, a documentary film called The Girl in the River, The Price of Forgiveness, that just won the Oscar for the best documentary short subject film, made by a Pakistani director, a woman, correct, about this notion of honor killing. So I wanted to talk about what we see this in many countries around the world, and I thought maybe you could talk to us a little bit about what honor killings are, what honor means.
Sure.
In the Islamic world in particular.
It's a complicated thing. First of all, let me say that for Pakistanis, this is huge, that this woman and this short documentary won the Oscar for best short documentary. It's had huge, the ripple effect just in the past week has been enormous.
In Pakistan.
In Pakistan. The Prime Minister, Nawaz Sharif, met with the director and went on record as saying, this has got to, legislation against honor killing has got to become law. And so he has at least stated that this has got to happen. What the problems are over there is that there are a million of them when it comes to this, but a lot of these honor killings don't get reported. But since I've been working over there, I've found that quite a few do, that the papers have started picking up on these stories. The data is inconclusive, but just to give you a ballpark sense, last year, probably about just under 1,000 were reported.
But explain to us what an honor killing
yes.
is. What does that
yes.
mean?
What it basically is, yeah, it is the killing usually, but not always, of a girl. Why? Because she wants to marry someone whom her parents do not want her to marry, or perhaps she wants to get divorced. In other words, she wants to go against the family's notion of what her role is in that family. The reason this film is so important is that this woman was one of the few who survived this. Mostly these killings are done with guns or sometimes acid being thrown in the face or some other form of torture. So most people don't survive to tell the story. In some cases, the family also goes after the man who's involved. Now, the key to both of this is the idea of compensation and punishment. In other words, what has happened in Pakistan up until the present is that murder is reduced to a sort of private jirga affair. This is a like a tribal council. It's reduced to a private affair between the killer and the victim's family. So what Sharif is trying to do is take it out of that and make it law. And so the irony, the horrible tragedy of all of this is that if you kill someone, okay, then you must pay a price to the family of the victim. But do you see the problem? The problem is most of these killings go on within the family, so that you're actually ending up paying the money to yourself, to another family member. There's also the notion of forgiveness, that if the perpetrator is forgiven, then he or she, God forbid, doesn't go to prison. And so what Parliament is now up against is to wipe out this idea of forgiveness and have this whole horrible thing law. And the reason this is really hard to handle and hard to make law out of is that so much of Pakistan is village life. It's traditional. It's remote. It's tribal. And I will add one other thing. I've heard Pakistanis say that one of the reasons why these killings are as widespread as they are is that the notion of the family and the importance of the family, which is huge, you can have a family with 800 members, is becoming even, they're digging in their heels even more as outside forces seem to threaten the stability and the existence of the family, i.e. American drone strikes that are landing on villages and on civilians.
Thanks, Adele. This is Maggie Zanger hosting a roundtable of women talking about our sisters around the world and some of the challenges that they face. This is KXCI FM in Tucson, Arizona, downtown on a Sunday afternoon. And we're going to continue our discussion. I think Adele has just brought up an important point about the central role of the family and the honor of the family, and that when people feel threatened, they pull back into the family. I think we've probably seen this around the world. So I wanted to ask Atifa about if there are any similarities that she sees in Afghanistan, and then we'll move on to Laura to talk about violence against women in Italy, and then bring it back to our own border. But Atifa, if you could talk about, do we see honor killings in...
It's very similar to what Adele was explaining about in Pakistan, especially in the tribal areas. I must admit that although the honor killing is happening quite a bit, because to save the faces of the families, so it's the honor of the families, it's the reputation that... that the families do not want to be, destroying in terms of their names. They have to really keep them intact. But it has nothing to do with religion. So I must admit that. It really is nowhere in Quran is indicating that you need to kill somebody to save the honor of your family. So it's not religious. It's pretty much it's in the tribal and ethnic lines that those places, Afghanistan and Pakistan. But again, the honor killing is not only happening in those lands alone, but it's because of the migration, because of the refugees moving all over the world. We're seeing quite a bit of an increased amount of honor killing happening in Europe and in London and in France. And we've seen them in Denmark. And a couple of years ago, there was an Afghan killed, their daughters because of that. And also it's that the tradition of the dating and meeting their boyfriends, this is not common in those areas. So when the refugees are moving to the Western cultures, their daughters are being exposed and they start dating. And so that really is, again, is the family honor is in question. So mostly in the terms of honor killing, if the couple are married, the person who's killing is the husband. In Afghanistan, about 26-27% of the killing is happening by the husband. And if it's not the husband, then the father is the second in line, or the brothers. So it's usually happening by the male figures in the family. And if they are not willing to do that, or if they're not in existence, then the council. The tribal council people will take their duties very seriously. And there was a case that happened a couple months ago. Rukhshana was 19 years old in a northern part of Afghanistan, and she decided to elope with her boyfriend, and he was 23 years old. What they did was they didn't punish the guy that much. They just gave him a couple of lashes. But what they put the girl, the 19 years old Rukhshana, in a hole, and they started stoning her. Then she was stoned to death. So this is very unfortunate. But as Adele said, these countries are trying to change their laws, and the current government of Afghanistan is very, very aware of the fact that they have to make changes. But again, there's a clash between the culture in the government, so that's been happening historically throughout the history of Afghanistan. So this is a very challenging area.
Well, again, I think we see how difficult change is everywhere, and it takes a long time. And the laws are a start, and it seems like if you can move these honor killings out of family, move it from being a family matter to it being a criminal matter, it's a start. But we all know how very slow change is, and patriarchy doesn't let go easily. And that'll lead us to Laura and Europe, which we think of as being a bastion of modernity, and it is, perhaps, but I think women still face challenges there.
Oh, yes, and what I find interesting is that many times we hear, about these events in the so-called East, that kind of justify our approach towards these countries as, like, we're justified to go there so we can liberate women, or, you know, those, you know, well, between quotes, you don't see me in radio, but between quotes, barbarians, you know, cultures that treat women, like, you know, in a very bad way. But the interesting thing is that a lot of times we use these kind of events not to see what goes on in our countries. And specifically in Italy, a lot of times we hear, like, about violence in the East against women, but we just pretend not to see what goes on within Italy. And I actually kind of looked at the data, because yes, we have International Women's Day, we celebrate it. There's a tradition of giving flowers to women as well. But the data about 2013 are pretty shocking, I would say, because 179 women got killed. So we're talking about one every 2 days, but it was domestic violence. So husbands, ex-husbands, either, like, also boyfriends, ex-boyfriends. So cases of women killed, not because of robbery or other incidents, but because there was a specific case of men that wouldn't allow the woman go and have a separate life, a different life, or starting a new life. So if we actually think, it's about 35% of the whole amount of people killed in Italy. And if we think that we still have, like, cases of violence because of, you know, criminal gangs, especially, like, for example, in the south, but also in the north. So we can see that there's a huge amount of women killed within the family. And still, like, those that don't get killed, still there's one of out of three that experienced physical or sexual abuse within the family. And so we kind of have to think about these things. And I think it's pretty important.
How would you rate the kind of level of, do women consider themselves feminist? And is that a term that's used in Italy? It's because you come out of a very progressive tradition.
Well,
as
that's,
well,
that's an interesting question, because well, we use the word feminist, but the problem is that right now, even younger, like a younger generation of women, is kind of thinking about feminism as a bad word, kind of like angry single women, this kind of image they want to portray. It's like, oh, we don't need feminism. And unfortunately, it gave these, gave, like, feminism was given, well, especially, like, by men, but also women, kind of like, especially younger generation, kind of like, started, like, acquiring this attitude towards feminism that's kind of preoccupying. And the good thing is that there's bloggers still that kind of try to take the word back, and especially in the context of, well, now 2016, and tried also to fight these still, like, overwhelming patriarchy in Italy, not just because of the church, but because of just men, I guess. And especially since we mentioned Berlusconi at the very beginning, this idea of objectification of women. So a big problem, for example, is that women are not really well represented in political institutions and the parliament. So we tried to introduce a minimum amount of number of women that should be elected, which is kind of like, you know, forcing kind of like people to elect women in the parliament. But the problem is that a lot of women, especially in the Berlusconi party, got elected because of sexual favors. So we still, like, yeah, I'm sorry. It's that. So I'm not too, you know, that's what happened. So you should probably think twice about your choice in the next elections. But that's actually a problem, like objectification of women and still using women as a as an exchange and getting position of power. So yes, we have women, but many of them have been elected in this other way, of got their position this way. So it's problematic.
Is there also, this is Maggie, is there also this notion of honor in the family? Not to the same extent, but is that in traditional society still a part
well,
of?
Well, it's probably going away now, but it's still there. So so first of all, we think about that, like, until about 30, 40 years ago, there was a lot, for example, in Sicily, that if a woman was raped, there was their reparation wedding, so she would have to marry her rapist to save the honor of the family. And then there was actually one woman, I'm sorry, I don't remember her name right now, but she was like, no, I'm not going to do that. And that created a scandal. The good thing is that her family supported her. But, like, the whole family was ostracized. And the thing is that it led to a new, like, a sort of, like, you know, moving things. But if we think that we changed the law about rape only in 1996, that rape was a crime, like a public offense, like against morality, not actually a crime against a person, like a violence against a person. It was just a public offense. So it was not really punished in terms of an actual crime, but more like a fine. So if we think about it, it was 1996, so 20 years ago. So there's still this idea of, well, there's a lot of going on, for example, in terms of victim blaming. So the idea of that if a woman gets raped, that's her fault. And the idea of, still, since you asked about honor, in, especially in small villages, the idea that you have to behave in a certain way if you don't want to become the talk of the town. Or it was pretty recent, the head of a school, of a high school, said, like, basically was a dress code that women should wear tank tops for, like, their own good. Like, oh my gosh. So, and it's 2016, so we're still talking about women, like, you know, dress codes, things like, you know...
Yeah,
and it's Italy.
it's modern Europe. Yes, as we said, things are slow to change. Just want to remind our listeners again that this is KXCI Radio, celebrating International Women's Day programming, talking with a number of women here, and we're going to bring it back. We've been talking about Russia, Pakistan, Afghanistan. Really, we want to bring it back to the Western Hemisphere, and I wanted to ask, we have with us here Anna Ochoa O'Leary, who has done a lot of research about women migrants, And you know, as we talk about honor in the family, I'm often reminded of the kind of Latino macho culture that we often hear about, and I generally think of machismo culture as an effort to control women and maintain male superiority. Is that off base, or do we see connections with some of these other societies?
I would very much agree with that statement. And we are in many ways related to a lot of the Roman, Latino cultures, Spanish cultures from the old world and into the new world, where a lot of the principles that guided women's, in patriarchal societies, the largest reason why women were the subject of such objectification and control was because they were seen as, you know, vectors of heredity, of bloodline. So then, in early times of Mexico, we had, there was this, this idea that women's, through childbirth, were reproducing certain bloodlines. And so we had, there was in Mexico, as part of the Spanish culture that came to the New World, this idea that the bloodlines were controlled by women giving birth to those children. And the only way you could control those bloodlines was to control women. Therefore, you had, the honor of the familia had to do with how well you were able to control the lives of those under your authority. And women, as part of that control, were the ones who were sequestered. They were behind walls. They were behind, very chaperoned. We have this, which is really interesting, because we have in the Spanish culture that came from the old world, some of those ideas that had been mixed with Islamic law, because there was 800 years of conquest of the Iberian Peninsula by many of the Arab and Islamic cultures, okay? And so then a lot of those ideas meshed into this idea that women were something that you controlled over time. And in many Latin American countries today, where many women, in fact, are fleeing those conditions that have them subjugated, these ideas of control of was related to childbirth, was related to obedience to the patriarchy and to the church. And, these were the many of the populations that still feel very strongly about about that they're anti right to choose because they still believe that much of their belief system is still pretty much ingrained in terms of this authority that comes from somewhere else, such as a God in the church. So yes, you have a population that is highly controlled by those who have benefited historically from the control of women, the control because that bloodlines were tied to property, wealth, the division of labor, and if you don't control that, then you become a poor household because you are unable to control those behaviors.
That sounds so familiar. Mm-hmm. This is Maggie, and speaking about very Arab cultures and more traditional cultures I've spent time in, it's very, very similar kind of situation. I'm wondering before I want to talk a little bit about contemporary times and perhaps social media, because several of you all do some research on social media and how that may have changed women globally. Are women in more contact with each other? Are we having deeper understanding of each other? But first, I wanted to ask Anna Ochoa O'Leary to talk maybe about migrant women, because all of us here in Tucson are quite aware of the numbers, and especially in recent years, of women and children who've been crossing the U.S.-Mexico border seeking safety. And I think a lot of that is of course, manipulated politically. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about that and where this is coming from, and maybe even what we in Tucson can do for our sisters who are in that position.
Many of your listeners probably already know, the rapid increase of women migrating as opposed to men migrating began in the mid-1990s, and a lot of that had to do with the passing of NAFTA. NAFTA devastated many of the rural economies that now are the largest sending communities since 1994. So a lot of those women who began to migrate, as much as perhaps as many as half of all migration are women migrating, they are fleeing we might call the economic violence, that economic policies such as NAFTA, which is the North America Free Trade Agreement signed between the U.S., Mexico, and Canada. They're fleeing that type of violence and the increased poverty. So in 2007, I had a research project on the border where I interviewed women who were fleeing this poverty. They were also fleeing. There were many reasons why they were fleeing their homelands. They were fleeing. They were suffering not only poverty, but everything else that comes with poverty, perhaps increase intimate partner violence. They were fleeing gang violence. They were fleeing the inability to support themselves after their husbands might have crossed into the United States and then abandoned them because they were no longer able to go back to Mexico to visit them and maintain those family ties. So many of those women who were coming up to United States were single women, and along the way then they're subjected to additional violence, such as the violence that comes from their traffickers, from police, and even from Border Patrol when they're arrested. So one of the things that we talk about is we talk about physical violence, but we also should be talking about the other types of violence, such as that which comes when we dehumanize women, when we call them through our political discourse. The popular discourse, which is really unfounded scientifically, is that women come to the United States just to have children, which is a fallacy. All research shows that women, in fact, Latina immigrant women of all the groups in the United States has had the sharpest decline in fertility rates than any other ethnic group in the United States. So, but facts notwithstanding, we tend to impose violence on them by the discourse we engage in, calling them Trojan horses, calling their children anchor babies, and we saw that in recent politics. And that is another kind of violence, and the violence that comes from humiliation and suspicion and the criminalization of women.
Great. Yeah, we've heard a lot about this recently. What can people do locally in support of? We talked earlier about the great number of women migrants around the world, and there's many ways we can help them, either by volunteering at places like the International Rescue Committee, by donating money. We are pretty comfortable. We can share our time and our effort. But right here in our own backyard, what would you suggest people do to assist women who are migrating into this country?
Well, aside from the things that you already mentioned, volunteering, but there are many NGOs, non-governmental organizations, I think, in all parts of the world, serving women all over the place, that are that provide aid to women, including Planned Parenthood, which we all know provides services to women all over the world, not just in Arizona or just in the United States. You know, continuing to support these organizations with our donations and time. The other thing is, on my end, I always ask people who, complain of, well, what could we do? There's nothing I can do. Well, one of the first things I ask, well, have you voted? Do you vote in the elections? Many people don't vote. They give up. They feel like if their vote doesn't count. But I think that's something that we still continue to work with, because I think if we all voted in the way that our conscience dictates, it might be something different. At least we'd be able to complain with a license. And these organizations, there's organizations here in Tucson, and I think we're blessed to live in a city that has one of the highest number per capita NGOs that are dedicated to progressive change and progressive ideas. Many immigrant rights groups. There's probably 10. I mean, there's so many that there's competition for volunteers and for funding. And the good thing is that Mexico is just right across the border, and a lot of good work being done by volunteers and NGOs on the Mexican side of the border as well. So these provide some immediate relief to women. If you go to the shelter, for example, right across the border, and simple things as the need for sanitary napkins for women. When I would be going down there, I would just take boxes there, because invariably there'd be, I'd ask, what can I do for you? And they would say, well, do you happen to have a sanitary napkin? Because, the shelter doesn't have, it's just too many people for them. Things like socks, people need clean socks, they need shoes and things like that, just to be able to either get them comfortable and either to return to their place of origin or continue on their journey as how they see fit. So there's a lot of humanitarian assistance that we can all give, and it doesn't have to be a lot, but I think as little as we might give, it means a lot for a lot of those people thinking that they are been abandoned and nobody cares for them.
Right. Solidarity, I think we all know, is important for women everywhere. I just want to remind our listeners, this is KXCI FM radio in Tucson, and we are celebrating International Women's Day. My name is Maggie Zanger. I'm here with the panel of women who have expertise in a various parts of the world. Adele Barker, who has spent a lot of time in both Russia and Pakistan. Linda Lumpson, a historian. Atifa Rawan, an Afghan woman who has spent a lot of effort trying to assist the people in her own country. Lara Tarantini, a new, well, soon-to-be PhD student working in Middle East and North African studies. And you were just hearing from Anna Ochoa O'Leary, who is the head of the Mexican-American Studies Department here at the University of Arizona. And she was encouraging people to get active, to take part. And you're right, we're lucky in Tucson. There's a lot going on. We're also lucky that through the miracle of the internet, we can donate money to refugee women in Syria or Afghanistan, or to women's causes in Italy, if we so choose. But I'm wondering if this is leading me to wonder about the internet and to think about ways that perhaps new technologies are bringing women closer together. I'm not sure we would have seen a few years ago a documentary film about honor killings in Pakistan win an Academy Award. And I'm just wondering And Laura, of course, as you know, these jihadi movements, these extremist movements, make great use of the internet.
Yes.
Do we think that women are also, are we in a more connected world? Of course, many of the women who are, you know, the worst off don't have contact. But those of us who do have resources, what, Linda, you've looked at this over the years. What do you think in terms of?
I think actually that women, like any group really in the world now, are very connected through the internet. You know, and I think digital activism has been behind a lot of programs and campaigns for women. From actually, I think individual campaigns to protest honor killings.
Wait, I think we can't hear you, Linda, on your microphone. Can you maybe try another microphone and see if this one's working? We were talking about social media and how women are now kind of more aware of what's going on.
Yeah. Okay. I hope this one's better. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Okay. I was going to say, yes, I think the internet has been a wonderful tool for women, as it has been for really any kind of advocacy group, to get together, to mobilize, you know, to share information, to get people in the streets, to seek out resources, and basically just educate people. And, you know, just a little bit of history. I can remember back to when the Taliban in the 90s was running Afghanistan the first time. That was one of the first, I think, internet campaigns or people were educated about the influence of the Taliban, I believe, by Afghan women. Am I right,
mm-hmm.
Atifa,
yes.
Getting online?
Yes.
And I think it's just really accelerated since then.
Yes. But speaking of Afghanistan, I think the internet use and the social media is a generation issue. I'm seeing a lot of the younger generation using, like, Facebook. There's a lot of communication that's happening in that. But as far as the older people, the women in Afghanistan are concerned, they're illiterate. So it's they don't have that kind of accessibility to the social media, to the internet. And another factor is also a very challenging issue is the access to the internet. The country is still developing. It still is in the infrastructure mode, so internet accessibility is not often there. But by and large, we are seeing quite a bit of use of the social media by the younger generation, the women. They are learning quite a bit. The impact of the social media has been great on women playing music and performing, and women being very involved in sports activities. In fact, the women bicyclist groups have been nominated by the Italian Parliament for the Nobel Prize this year. So this is fascinating. Yeah.
That's wonderful. And Adele, you were working with young women at a university.
Yeah,
did you find
that
also?
I'll just jump in here. Sometimes I wondered what country I was in. It felt like I was right here in Tucson, Arizona. They all took selfies. They were texting all of the time. They were on Facebook, this, that. I walked into class. I would say, okay, all iPhones off. But that was Rawalpindi, and that was a big city just down the road from the capital, Islamabad. And a lot of these girls, about 80% of them, were from villages. And when they got back to those villages, that was it. And you don't have internet connection out there. So I used to think, you know, how can we bring about change? And Pakistan is still developing. I mean, internet is very, very fragile over there. And I said to them, the best gift you can give your village is get yourself educated. Go back to that village and bring the gift of your education back there. And many of them are going to do that. And that, I think, in a country that is not as developed as ours, is still the way for women to reach women.
Well, and that's the point, I think. This is Maggie speaking, that I think Atifa was making about Afghan women. It is a generational issue, and we see each generation, hopefully, teaching each other and moving forward, helping each other move forward and making these connections around the globe. And to kind of wrap up this discussion, I'd like to just just pick up on something that Ano Cho'oleri was saying, which is that people do need to vote. I mean, it seems like a really simple thing. It seems like sometimes we're frustrated that it doesn't make for social change. It doesn't make for political change. But we got to keep doing it, and we got to keep acting like it will and that it can happen. And so I do encourage everyone in Tucson to register, get out there, vote, make your voice heard. We're pretty good in Tucson about making our voices heard. So we need to just continue that, and we need to think about our sisters around the world on International Women's Day and about the endless efforts that they are making. I'd like to thank you all for being here.
Thank you.
And thank you all for listening.